Hey, good Ner Shabbos, everyone. Welcome back to our three ideas in 30 minutes in pre-mincha edition of our shir, Baruch Hashem, Bar Mitzvah, after Marav tonight. So thank you all for your flexibility in coming at a different time. Tonight is sponsored by my mother, Debbie Moskowitz, in memory of her husband, my father, Mark Moskowitz, Moshe ben Avram, on his 24th Yahrzeit, which is the Shabbos. His neshama should have an aliyah. And of course, our learning is always the aliyah's neshama, Esther Tehila Bas Gabriel Pinchas as well. Today, we have not one idea in English, we have two ideas in English. So if you are one of those who is always scared off by the Hebrew, tonight is your night. The first idea comes from one of my favorite ideas, Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin tells the story as follows. There's a pasuk in the Parsha that I think, did Smichas Chavar cover this? Smichas Chavar, I think, covered this at some point. Biyomo sitein scharo velo safiyel ha-shemesh, ki anu hu ve'alav hu noseas nafsho velo yikra alecha ladonai ve'ya bechachet. There's an idea that you have to pay your workers on time. That is a mitzvah deraisa, that you have to pay your workers on time. Wow, see, there are benefits to doing it before mincha. Okay, so...
Not during bedtime.
So there is a mitzvah to pay your workers on time. Rabbi Riskin tells the following great story. He says that he was once sent in 1970 by the Lubavitcher Rebbe to four underground yeshivos, one in Moscow, one in Leningrad, one in Riga, and one in Vilna. Okay, and obviously he describes in great detail how he gets there, and he's traveled, and he's followed by four very tall and burly individuals who barely gave me breathing space. They literally surrounded me in the sanctuary where I was seated. Of course, you weren't allowed to teach Torah, and that's why he was being sent. Anyways, after he gets his aliyah, and it's a very small crowd, 28 people in a sanctuary that could hold 600, and as they're putting back the Torah, the gabbai, a short man with a white wispy beard, whispered to me in Yiddish, "We are thirsty for Torah. We have a kiddush after davening. We expect you to teach us. Please come down after davening, but without your friends." In other words, we don't need the KGB with us. Anyways, he finishes davening. The four guys disappear, and he goes into the pitch black room where 15 people are seated around the table. And he describes how there was a clear liquid, which he thought was water, which was not, slices of honey cake, and a chair for him. So the gabbai repeated, "We're thirsty for Torah," and he pours him a glass of this liquid, which ended up being vodka, and they made kiddush, and Rabbi Riskin gave a dvar Torah. And then they did it again, and he poured a shot of vodka, and Rabbi Riskin said a dvar Torah, and this repeated itself numerous times, okay? Says Rabbi Riskin at the bottom of page number one, "By the ninth time, no matter how hard I racked my brain, I didn't have any more words of Torah to give on Parshas Ki Teitse. In a group of 15, many of whom were young, and I learned later, studying for conversion to Judaism, I recognized the Torah reading from Shul. His name was Yisrael Friedman, and he was a staunch Chabadnik. I asked him to teach instead of me. He agreed, and it was this lesson that changed my life." Here were his words. He describes the Gemara of Elisha ben Avuya, who we know sees a child going up the tree, the child falls and dies, and Elisha says, "This is how Hashem rewards people who are doing the right thing. It must be that there's no reward for commandments in this world." So Rabbi Friedman, or this individual, whose name was Yisrael Friedman, looked out at the basement assemblage with blazing eyes and then looked heavenward. He said, "But God, how is that fair? How can you expect your Jewish servants to pay the day labor on the very day when you withhold our reward for commandments until after our lifetime in the world to come? It's simply not fair." Rabbi Friedman answered his own question. The Gemara in Baba Bat Metzia differentiates between a day laborer, which is a sachir, and a contractor, which is a kablan. Yes, he says, a day laborer must be paid at the end of the day. That's exactly what we're talking about in our parsha this coming Shabbos. But a contractor is to be paid only at the end of the project. Then he says the following, "We, vis-a-vis God, are not day laborers. We are contractors, each of us given his or her unique gift in the time and place in which he or she lives, must do his share in helping to complete the world in the kingship of God. Whether we have performed the right function or not, whether we have done most of them or little of them, or perhaps we're in the wrong ballpark altogether, can only be determined at the end of our lifetimes. For us contractors, there is no reward for commandments in this world." Isn't that an unbelievable idea? Unbelievable on this parsha. So this pasuk b'yomos itein scharo says this Yitzchak Friedman, Hashem, I understand, Yisrael Friedman, I understand. You require us to pay the laborers on time. You don't pay us on time. You delay payment until the next world. He says, ah, because you're misunderstanding it. Because the Gemara says that only applies to a sakhir, a day laborer. Yes, that he has to be paid on time. But a kablan, someone who's a contractor, then you could pay at the end of the job. Says Yisrael Friedman, in the words of Rabbi Riskin, each of us here in this world, we are kablans, we are contractors, which means that we are here for a job. We are here on a shlichut. We are here with a mission and a purpose. And that can only be determined whether we were successful or not, not day by day, or not month by month, but only at the end of our lives. He writes at the end, despite the 9 vodkas, or perhaps because of them, I was moved to tear by his words. After witnessing firsthand the persecution of Soviet Jewry upon the heels of the Holocaust atrocities, I was overwhelmed by thinking of God's great gift of the newborn state of Israel. I felt deeply in my heart that I cannot possibly have been born in a free country in these most momentous times in order to fulfill a function in New York. So in the basement of Riga, I made an oath. I will bring my family to the state of Israel and hopefully there realize my function. And when I got to Israel, I will make Kiddush on vodka every Shabbos afternoon. Now, this is not an endorsement of the Kiddush Club. It is not an endorsement of vodka, which I certainly do not endorse if you are going to go to the Kiddush Club. But I think it is an unbelievably beautiful idea in the Parsha. When the Torah tells us you have to pay your day laborers, that only applies to a sakhir, a day laborer, a contractor, a kablan. He gets paid not every day, but at the end of the job. Says Rabbi Riskin, each one of us is a contractor. We're a kablan, which means that we delay our reward. That's the difficulty of Judaism. We don't see that immediate reward that we so desperately crave, but rather it is waiting for us in the world to come. That is idea number one from Rabbi Riskin. I think a very beautiful idea with a great story to go along with it. Okay, idea number two.
I think we get a reward every single day just being alive.
You get a reward every single day by being alive. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, here we go. The Parsha tells us later on, Ki inatsu, this is in Perek Chafei, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Ki inatsu anashim yachdav. No, that's not what we say. Just kidding. Where are we? Ki yeriv bein anashim, Perek Chafei, Pasuk Aleph. Ki yeriv bein anashim, v'nikshu al mishpat u'shvatum, v'itztiku as a tzadik, v'hirshu as a rasha. That when, this is of course talking about Malchus, but the Torah introduces it by saying, Ki yeriv, that when there is a, how do you describe riv? A fight. Riv is a fight. Now we know that there are different words that can be used to describe fighting. So for example, you can use the word katata, right? We say that, where do we say that? We say that, where is that? Can you help me out? All right, use the word katata.
Is it an al-chait or
no, you know what it is? It's right, it's by Birchas Kohen maybe?
No, it's in,
All right, whatever. Someone's going to look it up and I'm going to feel like an Amaretz, which I am, but at least I'll feel that way, okay? Right? So we have different words for machlokes, kitata. We have different words. So why Reeve? What's the unique nature of Reeve? Listen to this word by Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg in his Sefer, what?
Ataris
Nedarim, that's where it is? Okay, could be. Okay, so it's in Ataris Nedarim, okay. Right, so Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg in his Sefer Aksav, Vea Kabbalah. I saw this in an email that Yeshiva Shalavim sends out each week, and I looked it up, and it's even more magnificent than I thought. He writes here that there are two types of arguments. One type of an argument is what he calls Ala Machlokes Hamaguna Shu Matsui Benashim Uviyoshvei Kranos. I will not translate that literally, but literally means people who have nothing better to do but they argue all day. Okay, so they're sitting around and they're arguing. And how do they argue? So they might use divisive language, they might not speak properly, they might raise their voice, they might curse, right? That's one type of an argument. There's really no point to it, but they're just arguing in a almost diminishing kind of way, where it diminishes the person. But he writes here the following. Aval inyan hariv. Riv means something totally different. Riv lohunach rak al min machlokes hanosadot al inyan asher yugim mena to'elas vischar chartov. Reeve represents a form of machlokes that is, like, worthwhile. In other words, it's something that is reasonable to be arguing about. Not something that's just like, oh, you did this to me, I did this to you, let's argue and fight and escalate. No, this is like a legitimate argument. We have a disagreement, you're putting a tree up, you're building a second floor on your house, I think you're going to look into my pool, I have this understanding of our financial deal, you have that understanding of our, right? There are legitimate arguments that happen. He says that is what Reeve represents, right? Where it's asher yigil toeles, there's a purpose for it. V'sachar tov, in other words, they're both l'shem shamayim. Both people think that they're correct, and they're doing it in a nice way, right? Kigon sherivu bishvil sadeh, maybe they're arguing over a field, bayis v'shar chefetz, they're arguing over something, right? Sometimes people get into business arguments. Sometimes people get in arguments over, you know, borders on their houses. Right? There are all things, lots of things that people reasonably argue about. Okay. He says that is what Reeve represents. Reeve represents a fight that, or an argument that is worthwhile. In other words, that makes sense. And therefore he says, v'zeh min machlokas bilti meguna ba'atzmo. There's nothing wrong with this machlokas. It happens all the time. Aval huroi lios. It has to be. There's always going to be machlokas. There are always going to be people who argue. There are always going to be people that disagree. There's always going to be business fighting. By the way, if you want to know the proof of that, it's that it appears in the Torah and that the Gemara spends so much time talking about these issues. Business machlokas is not something new. It's been going on for a long time. He says, "Shafila b'dinei mamonos," even when it comes to money, it's a person. It's acceptable for a person to want to do what's best for him. And so if I feel that I'm right, and you feel that you're right, so we're going to disagree. But then listen to what he says on the bottom of that paragraph. Ela shetzarech shiyeh mitzamtzein bedavar. Even in this argument, again, don't forget, kitata, he says, is an argument that's two people screaming and cursing and arguing or nothing. Reev, as in kiyeh reev bein anashim, represents a type of argument that is worthwhile. It makes sense. It's understandable. But even in that type of argument, you have to be mitzamtzeim. How do you translate mitzamtzeim?
Belittle.
You have to belittle, you have to contract yourself. You have to be mevater on yourself a little bit. Shalotiyeh, and these are the words that I found so amazing. Takanaso, kilaso. You want to make sure that you don't lose in your victory. You want to make sure that even though you might win that monetary argument, you're going to lose in the long run. That even in your win, you might have won the battle, but you're actually going to lose the war. Rotz Lomar, how does that happen? Shelo yatzei mitocha tikun ahu, that because you're trying to right a wrong, shu rotz latakin, that you're trying to fix, kilkul hashakul yosim natikun. You're going to end up doing more damage than anything you would have fixed by adjudicating this disagreement. And that, by the way, chevra, you see all the time. You see all the time. I think I'm right, you think you're right. It's legitimate, it's understandable, and it's reasonable, and there are ways to adjudicate that. But what ends up happening is, because I think I'm right, and because you think you're wrong, so it escalates slowly but surely until eventually it escalates into a massive fight where people don't talk and families don't talk. That is exactly what he's saying, where your takana, you're fixing a little problem, kilkalaso actually causes you a much bigger problem because now you have machlokes, now you're not talking to people, now you have a shame ra in the community, right? So
that's
he says, because...
Your wife is always right.
What?
That's why your wife is always
Your wife
right.
is always right, exactly, right? By the way, that's a great example. How many people have tried, I just tried to point something out, I just tried to help her a little, right? And it ends up causing much more... You can win the battle, but lose the war. You can win this little piece of a machlokes, but lose in the long run. That's what he says. Shurotzil atakin kilkul ashakal. You're trying to fix one problem, but what happens? You end up causing a much bigger problem. Shelo ya'ara bedavar hariv, that because of this completely understandable machlokes, what happens that you have with your friend, what emerges from that is kas, is anger, v'nekama, in revenge, v'neyatsu v'chiyotze mina toledas hashechichos v'mnimshachos mina eder haskama. In other words, Reeve represents a type of machlokes that says, you're allowed to disagree. You're allowed to have arguments. It's going to happen. It happens in marriages. It happens in business. It happens with neighbors. But that doesn't give you the right to therefore do whatever it takes to win the argument. Because sometimes when you try to win the argument, what you end up ultimately losing is something much greater. You lose the relationship. You lose the closeness. You lose the intimacy. You lose the trust. I can't tell you how many times in cases that because you tried to win, and you might even won, but you lose trust in a relationship. And that, my friends, it takes a much longer time to win back. Sometimes a lifetime to win back. That, says the Ksav Kabbalah, is what this word Reeve represents. It's not stam machlokas.
Isn't Reeve also to rebel?
like May Mariva.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, in the next paragraph, I thought you were going to say something else because I thought you looked ahead a little bit. He says, that's why Riv comes from the word Rabbanut. Now, Rabbanut is not like rabbi. Rabbanut means, I mean, again, you guys will laugh, but like a position of esteem, right? In other words, something that is respected and revered. So he says, first of all, that means, Rabbanut means like each one is trying to get the upper hand. That's what, in a Riv, in an argument, each one wants to win. But then he says, Riv represents that even in that machlokas, you have to act like Rabbanut. Now, you have to act in a certain way. You have to carry yourself with a certain dignity. Just because you are in a dispute with someone, just because you have a monetary dispute, or just because you have a business dispute, or just because you have a dispute over a fence, or because your neighbor's putting up a second floor, whatever the case might be, does not give you the right to not act with complete decency. And therefore, he says, the word Riv comes from Rabbanut, reminding you that even within the machlokas, even within the disagreement, you still have to act in a certain way, and you still have to carry yourself with a certain sense of dignity. And therefore, he says, that's what this pasuk means. Ki yeriv bein anashim. Okay, there's an argument, there's a grievance between two people. But the word riv comes to remind us that even in that grievance, even in that dispute, it does not give you the right to mistreat or to misbehave on yourself, to fly off the wall, to seek revenge, right? And again, we see this maisim b'chol yom. I recently had this exact case where someone got very upset at someone else, called them up on the phone, and lashed out at them, completely lashed out at them. And this person came to me afterwards, and they were literally shaking. Maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong, but the response was so disproportionate. They were so devastated. It's Elul, how could it be? Someone feels that way about them. And then what ends up happening 10 out of 10 times is that the person who was upset ended up apologizing to the person that he was upset at. In other words, even though he was upset, but because he responded in such a ridiculous, outlandish way, he was the one who ended up apologizing to the person who upset him in the first place. Right? That's Riv. Riv means just because you have a dispute with someone doesn't mean you can fly off the handles. It doesn't mean that you can reduce yourself to kas. Because you might solve one problem. You might win that monetary dispute. You might win with your neighbor. You might win with the spouse. But you know what you're going to lose? You're going to lose something so much worse. You're going to lose that trust. You're going to lose that relationship. You're going to lose that closeness. You're going to lose your reputation, right? There's so much that you can lose in the process. I've spoken about this. I don't know if, you know, someday someone will do like a study on rabbis' drushas. And you'll notice that rabbis oftentimes speak about one or two themes, like in bunches, because it's on a rabbi's mind. This happens to be on my mind a lot. I fundamentally see it. And as I've gotten older, I realize it more and more. That most of the time, machlokas is not worth it. Most of the time, you go in for a little thing and it ends up being something much bigger because each one escalates and digs in their heels and becomes stubborn and it becomes something much bigger than it needs to be. And it destroys relationships, it destroys homes, it destroys communities. It is destructive. And that's why I gave drush about it this summer. Most of the time, it simply is not worth it. But even if it is worth it, that's what the Ksav HaKabbalah is pointing out. Even when it's Riv, even when it's totally understandable why you're having a disagreeing, you have to be a mensch. You still have to conduct yourself in a certain way. You still have to make sure that you're treating the other person with the respect that they deserve. So that is idea number two. Again, idea number one was this beautiful idea from Riskin about paying day laborers on time, the sachir versus the kaplan. Idea number two comes from the Ksav VeHaKabbalah about the word riv, that there's a way to fight, and there's a way to fight. And we have to learn the right way to fight, and not the wrong way to fight, and avoid the destructive negative consequences that sometimes comes with arguing. Okay, idea number three, and I saved what I think is the best for last, but it's also the most esoteric for last, and so I acknowledge that fully. And it's the halacha of Yibum. So we know that the halacha of Yibum is that if there's two brothers, one of them is married to a woman, and they don't have children, and then he passes away. So on his brother, there's a mitzvah of Yibum to marry his sister-in-law. And if he chooses not to, then there's a mitzvah of Chalitza, which is where you take off the shoe and you spit and whatever. I actually heard a case recently of a yeshiva guy who was learning Maseches Yevamos in yeshiva, which is challenging in and of itself. And all of a sudden he's thinking, he's like, oh, he's like, you know, my grandfather's brother or whatever. And he's like playing the scenario out in his head, and he's like, Taka, that's a case of Yibum. And he went home and told his parents, and Taka is a case of Yibum, and at a much older age, the grandparent was like 80-something years old, they had to go and do Yibum. They had never done it for years. So these are halachos. You know, and they did chalitza, obviously, right? But these are halachas that you're in the Berdugo. These are halachas that apply. Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson has a stunningly beautiful idea on this. I'm going to read it for you in Hebrew, because you have to read the Hebrew, but you can read it in English with you as well. The pasuk says, Ki yeshvu achim yachdav. When you have two brothers that are sitting together, umeis achad mehem, and one of them dies, uben ein lo, and he doesn't have a child, losia eishes hameis hachutza li shazar, this wife, this now widow, she should not marry a stranger. Rather, yevama yavo aleo lekacha lo liisha. But he should come, and the brother, keep it in the family. Listen to what Rabbi YY says on this. He says, in Midrashic and Kabbalistic literature, parents symbolize intellect and awareness, while children and siblings represent emotions and feelings. Therefore, when the Torah describes the situation of brothers living together, it is also referring to two forms of human emotions, represented by two siblings. So these siblings, again, this is Pnimis HaTorah. It's understanding the psukim. There's a depth to the psukim that you and I can't see. And what he's describing is that these two brothers are really two paradigms of emotions. The first category of emotions are what you and I would colloquially refer to as our emotions. These are the emotions and feelings that we experience on a daily basis that cover the entire spectrum of our lives. Anger, happiness, sadness, joy, laughter. Okay, that's category number one. The second and far more mysterious category of emotions are what I call subconscious feelings, but he calls superconscious feelings, stemming from the primal formations of the human psyche transcending our conscious awareness and cognition. So we have emotions that we're aware of, and we have emotions that we are unaware of. We have things that lie beneath the surface that you and I are not aware of. They're superconscious, or what I'll call subconscious. We are not always aware of them. The emotions experienced in our conscious personality often originate within the superconscious, but are strictly contracted and filtered by our brain. There is, however, a much deeper and primal level in which each of us professes incredibly profound paradoxical and rich yearnings, cravings, and experiences. In other words, there's something inside of us that we can't always define and which doesn't always manifest itself on a daily basis, but it formulates who we are. Listen to what Rabbi YY says, and it is so, so magnificent. He says, a situation of brothers living together, one of them marrying and having children, represents metaphorically a healthy and functional individual whose superconscious emotions fuel and give birth to a more structural conscious. In other words, when your superconscious or subconscious emotions are in sync with your regular emotions, that is a healthy, well-balanced person. But then he says in the next paragraph, and this is the part that spoke to me, but sometimes in a situation when brothers live together and one of them dies childless, the Torah is referring to the death of the conscious heart of man, describing the tragedy of a human being whose burning blaze of love, inspiration, enthusiasm, and caring has been extinguished in lieu of a vibrant, passionate, sparkling spirit who knows how to cry and laugh, how to embrace and let go. This person turns into a numb and frozen creature, paralyzed and shut off. The first brother, the feelings and emotions that give life its twinkle and passion, is dead. And you see that tragically in some people, that they are emotionally numb, they are emotionally hardened, and they are emotionally cold or distanced or shut off. During such moments, again, that brother died, that set of emotions died. During those moments, we often succumb to emptiness, despair, and addiction. And the first victims of depression are those with whom we build relationships. When our flow of inspiration dries up, we tend to withdraw into a cocoon, isolating ourselves from the world, from our loved ones, and from ourselves. We feel depressed and childless, unmotivated to have an impact that might outlast our physical lives. So what do you do? What do you do when that one brother dies? What do you do when your emotions become numb and stale and cold and hardened? You say to yourself, I've been doing Elul my whole life. I haven't changed. I've gone through this. I've tried 150 times. I just read, actually, I'm thinking of giving a shiur about this on Rosh Hashanah, about a great rabbi in the 18th century who struggled with gambling addiction. And he writes in the Sefer about the gambling addiction. I thought it was so amazing. It was tragic. It was amazing and inspiring and also tragic at the same time because he never conquers it. And yet I just found how autobiographical, honest he was. I found it so refreshing and inspiring that he never gave up the fight. Right? So what happens when you fought it for 20, 30, 40 years, you can't crack it, and you feel emotionally hardened, and you feel numb, and you feel that you're just going through everything. So what do? Comes the Torah and declares, the wife of the deceased man shall not marry outside the strange man. His brother-in-law shall come to her. What does this mean, he says? The wife of the deceased man alludes to the neshama, the soul of a person. In such an instant, the Torah instructs you not to sell your destiny to the devil of depression or addiction. In other words, don't look for things outside yourself. Remember, right? Li'ish zar. Don't look outside for you. Don't think that the answers are going to be in other things. Rather, right, allowing for the death of your marriage and dreams. Now that all of your conscience passions are lost, it is time to call in the second brother, the higher, superconscious, infinite powers of the human being to fill the shoes of the first brother and perpetuate the relationships that the first brother began. What we're going to call here the Pintaliyid, or the Chelek Elokam Imal, or the Neshama that's inside of each one of us. That's that superconscious. It's in us, and it motivates us and informs everything that we do. We're not always aware of it, and we're not always tapped into it. But when everything else is numb and cold and dried out, that's when you have to tap into that neshama tahora. You have to remind yourself of who you are in your essence, that you might have sinned, but you're not a sinner. You might gamble, you're not a gambler. You might drink, but you're not a drinker. It doesn't define who you are. It's a mistake that you made. It's something you have to fix, but it doesn't define your essence. Your essence is this superconscious. So when that first brother died, when those emotions have gone cold and numb, you have to revert back to your primal, infinite essence, which is a neshama tahora. What this means on a practical level, he says, is that when you're standing at the abyss, ready to be consumed into oblivion, again, li'ish zar, you're going to go outside yourself. And think about how many people we know try to solve their problems by external things. Addiction, drugs, alcohol, right? They think the solution is going to be outside of themselves. I was just talking to someone this week. And he said, Rabbi, I just realized, whatever circumstance, that everything I always had was right in front of me the whole time, but I didn't realize it. And now, because of my actions, I need to now work to get it back. Right? We look outside of ourselves, but it's within us, he says. So he says, when you're standing at the abyss, ready to be consumed into oblivion, you must know that deeply embedded within your spirit lies an incredibly profound and heroic spark. You may not be able to fully comprehend it, right? We don't feel that neshama tahora. We don't feel that pintaliyid. We don't feel that chelek elokam imal inside of us. But if you believe in it and you embrace it, it will carry you through the times of emotional desolation. That is like earth shattering. And if you don't fully appreciate it, I encourage you to read these psukim and then reread what Rabbi YY said. Ki yeshu achim achdav. You have these two brothers, you have the superconscious emotions and your real emotions. Umeisechad mehem, in circumstances, you go cold and you go numb and you become hardened. So what do you do? Right? So what does he say? Lo siya eishes ameis hachutza li'ish zar. Don't look for things outside to solve the problem. Rather, yavo aleol kachalo li'isha vivama. You now welcome in that second brother, that what we're going to call that profound and heroic spark that exists inside of each one of them. He goes on, and I didn't even quote the whole article, but he goes on and says, this is not just us as individuals, this is the Jewish people as a whole. Quotes a pasuk from Amos and others, that even when we feel that Hashem has divorced us, even when we feel that Hashem has abandoned us, right, we too, there's always that second brother, that relationship that we have with Hashem that will never be severed, not by a Holocaust, not by pogroms, not by crusades, not by the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. All of that's one brother, but there's that second brother that will never be severed and that will never be taken away. And so says Rabbi YY, this is not just a pasuk about Yibum, but it's a profound pasuk about human psychology and how to overcome those moments of coldness, those moments of despair, those moments when you feel paralyzed and emotionally shut down. That's when, instead of looking outside yourself, that is when you go to the second brother. So we saw three ideas in 30 minutes. Idea number one from Rabbi Riskin. How do you remember the guy's question, Yisrael Friedman's question, that night in Moscow? He says, I understand, if you have to pay your workers on time, so why doesn't Hashem have to pay us on time? He says, there's a difference between a schir and a kablan. A schir, a day laborer, that you have to pay on time. A kablan, a contractor, that you could pay at the end. We Jewish people are contractors. We have a job, we have a mission, we have a purpose. And that's only going to be adjudged after 120 years. Idea number two came from Yaakov Mecklenburg, the word riv, that there's a way to fight and there's a way to fight. We have to learn to fight appropriately, disagree agreeably, and not chas v'shalom the opposite way. And idea number three came from Rabbi YY, really like a stunning, you have to really think about what he's saying here. But the understanding of Yibam, al pnimiyas haTorah, of understanding who the two brothers are, that even when one of the brothers is no longer functional and you're paralyzed and emotionally shut off, how do you stay connected and not fall into the abyss? With that, I wish everyone a good Shabbat.